Welcome to the Science Witch Podcast, where we explore how science and witchcraft intersect, interact, and affirm one another. I'm your co-host, James.
I'm your co-host, Ruby.
I'm your co-host, Angel.
And I'm your co-host, Inku. And this is our 70th episode and our solstice offering for the holiday season. In this episode, we got to speak with one of my favorite witchy authors and general go-tos for insights into my own Celtic pagan practices and path, Morgan Daimler.
This was a flawless interview that I really enjoyed. Talking to Morgan was such a holiday treat, and we got into some deep cuts about how Victorians gave us a lot of the, quote, ancient traditions we ascribe to pre-Christian pagan society, and then we debunk some of the myths surrounding the origins of Christmas celebrations, including the Christmas tree. It's not an ancient pre-Christian tradition. So next time you see that meme going around on social media about how Christians stole the Christmas tree from pagan traditions, you can totally, well, actually, and point to the references in the show notes. So we also talked about how it's okay to make your own holiday traditions. And just because something isn't ancient doesn't mean it isn't valid. And just because something is ancient doesn't mean we have to continue to practice it in our celebrations just because our ancestors did.
Morgan is really passionate about getting to the primary sources. And we really appreciated that. Sorry about that. We really appreciated that she knew her stuff when it comes to understanding the actual language and translating from 8th and 9th century Welsh. We even broached the topic of white nationalism and Scottish fairy lore, which is absolutely something we have to bring her back on the show to delve into further.
And before we jump in, I'd like to give a quick shout out for any other Celtic pagan folk who might be listening. I'd like you to know about an upcoming online class that I'm super excited about with T. Thorne Coyle called Holy Wells and Sacred Flame, Spending Time with Bridget. This is a 5-week exploration of getting closer to the triple goddess of flame, holy well, and poetry. The inaugural meeting is in late January 2025, and you can find more info on Teachable, and we'll have a link in the show notes. Neither Teachable nor T. Thorne Coyle is sponsoring this episode. I'm just really pumped about it. I've already signed up, and I would love to see any other Science Witch podcast friends in the class. So if you're already a lover of the Celtic powers, or if you're just inspired by Morgan Daimler in this episode, go check it out.
And I also got to say, I missed out on this interview for work reasons. Although before we went to record, we did talk about the episode for quite a while about how freaking great it was. And 1,000% we're going to have Morgan come back. This is not the last you've heard of Morgan. The way my fellow co-hosts were just talking about her even before the recording, it's going to fucking happen. So without further ado, here's our solstice episode for closing out 2024.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Science Witch Podcast. Today, we have our special solstice episode for 2024. And with us today, we have Morgan Daimler. And Morgan is an author and an expert on all things having to do with the Irish mythology and the Tuatha Dé. And so before we delve into our topic today, Morgan, can you start out by introducing yourself to our listeners and for folks who may be new to your work?
Hello, everybody. I'm excited to be here today. I basically have been a practicing witch since the early 1990s. I got into it when I was very young. So, I mean, take that time range with a bit of a grain of salt there at the beginning. And I've always had an interest in Irish mythology and folklore, part of the Irish American diaspora. My grandfather was from Ireland. So it's always been sort of an interest that I had, and those two things intersected really nicely for me as a teenager. And I got very into researching and studying the history of things and how we kind of got where we are today. I am 100% that person who likes to trace things back to where they started and kind of figure out how that process happened. That fascinates me. So I'm going to feel so old when I say this now. About 24 years ago, I started publicly teaching, particularly about fairies. And about 14 years ago, I started writing. I'd been doing a little bit before that, but, you know, more focused at that point, and found that there were a lot of other people that were also really interested in the things that I was interested in, the Irish gods in particular, and fairies, and all the folk beliefs and everything associated with that. So I kind of have found myself now in this weird place where I do a lot of academic work about folklore. I present at university conferences and all that fancy stuff. But then I also do a lot of teaching and writing for explicitly pagan audiences, witchcraft audiences, which are two very different communities. Surprising amount of overlap, but still very different audiences. So I think they both kind of help me. The academic helps keep me grounded. And then the paganism, the witchcraft helps keep me numinous in my focus. So it's really a great combination. And hopefully my writing brings both of those things through.
I can, you know, just gush a little bit as a longtime fan of your work and say it definitely does.
That's good to hear.
I put you really in the top of the other people that are doing similar work as you. I'm just really thankful for that dual perspective. So like you and Courtney Weber and Laura O'Brien and Anthony Murphy, it opens up ways of interacting with this realm of spirituality that, you know, people in the United States have never had before until y'all started this sort of wave of really taking the history seriously and taking modern practice seriously and putting those together. Yeah. We're all incredibly lucky to have you and your colleagues that are doing similar work.
I appreciate you saying that, because that's very flattering to be in that particular company. I love all those people you just listed. I think that it didn't used to be this way, again, having come into paganism and witchcraft in the 90s. And I love that we're moving into a place where people are a little more rigorous with sources and citing where information is coming from, but also still very spiritual. I think for a while we had this weird idea that you couldn't do both, that if you were really academic, you couldn't be spiritual. And if you're really spiritual, you didn't have any academic anything going on. So I love that we're getting into a place where the streams are crossing.
Which is so ironic. Like when you think about Christianity, Judaism, like any other major religion, like science and religion or science and spirituality have gone hand in hand throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that we're getting into that place too as a community. I think it makes us stronger to have both of those influences going on.
Yeah, and especially within traditions that are, you know, broken lineages or at least highly fractured lineages, being able to recognize that even our oldest sources are imperfect actually gives us today a lot of freedom and leeway that we might not have if it had been always sort of ossified into one sort of system, right? Like, I feel like it allows us to stay grounded, but still with a lot of creativity, which I think is, I mean, like you were kind of saying earlier, I think before we started filming, as long as we're like clear where we're getting this inspiration, is this, you know, unverified personal gnosis, or is this coming out of one of the old sources, and being able to figure out how to hold those in sort of a dynamic equilibrium is a really exciting place to be.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. And I think that you have to have that balance, because if it's just relying on the old sources and it's just looking at what people did 1,000, 2,000 years ago, it gets very stagnant. There's no creativity to it. It's just let's repeat what we can find. But if you're totally focused on the creativity and innovation, there's no foundation, there's no roots to it. It's just sort of chaos. And I realize some people like that. So not criticizing people listening to this that are into the pure chaos, but I think that balance works the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's this topic of Irish / Celtic magic has, you know, come a long way from the DJ Conway days of, I think I read somewhere that one of the like worst books on magic was this Celtic magic book, which was just a bunch of just misinformation and just speculation. And so I'm glad that you've redeemed this as something that both can be like spiritually inspirational, but also grounded in a historic framework. Because yeah, I mean, I definitely like was gravitating towards Celtic magic when I was first coming into my you know, witchcraft practice. I think we're probably close to the same age, so at like 14, 15, I was really just trying to find everything I could about this idea of quote Celtic magic. And as a result, I you know, not having the research background or the ability to really like vet the sources, I picked up Celtic magic and I was super excited about it. And then, you know, later on I realized, oh wow, this is just a bunch of bunk information. This is more like a role-playing book than an actual
sad but true.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there's, can you speak about that a little bit in terms of your own experience with this particular topic in framing it and bringing it into the witchcraft and paganism discourse?
Sure. So, as I said, I kind of came out of the 90s with where I was coming from, beginning with all this. And the 90s were not a good decade for solid information, particularly on anything Irish or Celtic. Celtic being sort of a general term for Irish, Scottish, Welsh cultural paganism that gets kind of squished together. But Celtic was the term of the 90s. And at the time, because, you know, myself as well at that point, you don't have the background knowledge, you don't have the familiarity with the subject to realize that what you're reading is nonsense and that it's just literally authors just making things up and then claiming that it's coming from these sources that it's not coming from. And, you know, I also look back and cringe a little at some of the things I was saying or doing related to that during that decade. But what happened for me, at least, was as I got further into it and I started digging more into the academic end of it, I started to realize that those things were not lining up. Starting to learn to speak the Irish language, I realized, particularly, this was one of my initial things, was that a lot of those books would say, oh, this word means this thing. And it does not. It does not even mean anything like in the general range or area of that thing. They were just making stuff up. And I think once I realized that, it really inspired me to start digging a lot harder and also made me want to share what I was finding with other people, because you don't know what you don't know. I mean, it's not anyone's fault if you're reading a bad book and you don't know that it's a bad book and then you're perpetuating that information. And I realized that not a lot of people are in the position that I'm fortunate enough to be in, where I have some ability with the language. I've studied the older, Old and Middle Irish, which is where a lot of the mythology comes from in writing. And I've dug into the academic material in a way that I know a lot of people don't have access to. And that's a privilege. And I appreciate that. And I understand why other people don't have that. So of course, you're not going to realize that, you know, when people talk about the goddess Fladish having horns, that's a very modern concept. That doesn't make it wrong, but it's not something we find in the older material. So when you see books and sources saying, oh, she's a horned goddess, she was the horned goddess of the Irish, and that's just not factually correct historically. In modern practice, you know, a lot of people see her that way, and that's the different concept. But I figured that I might as well do some good with that privilege that I have for this and try to share the accurate material as I was finding it and help people get to better sources. Sorry, I get a little ranty about this.
No, that's totally understandable, because I, you know, I really appreciate that as somebody who, when I first came to witchcraft, I was like really wanting to find sort of what my ancestral practice is. And I feel like, you know, I love Scott Cunningham. He definitely was like some of my introduction into witchcraft. But, you know, I was reading through my 16-year-old journal, and I was under the impression that Wicca was this ancient religion, and that the goddess, there would be like 2,000 years ago, there was in ancient Ireland a Wiccan cult. And I was like, why did I think this? What exactly? And then, you know, when I was looking back at some of Cunningham's work, he doesn't really talk about the history of Wicca. So it, yeah, you know, it's good to finally be able to take what was at the time all we had and just be like, okay, bless our heart, we didn't know any better, but now we do, and we have much better references and resources. So yeah, I really appreciate that you being somebody to help bridge that and give the both the historical scientific information as well as the spiritual aspects of it. So we'll turning to the kind of what we wanted to talk about today in terms of our solstice celebrations. And around this time of year, you start seeing a flurry of posts on social media talking about some of the ideas of what people think are ancient pagan traditions of the holidays. And one of them I actually mentioned in my beginning email to you, which just kind of shows you my own ignorance, is about the Christmas tree. And, you know, I had seen all these memes about how the Christmas tree is this ancient pagan tradition that the Christians stole from us. And you were like, no, that's not true. So I thought we could start out by maybe like talking about some of these traditions, and then like where you find what exactly is a what would be considered a tradition of pre-Christian times that we can practice, and then like maybe even debunking some of these ideas about what isn't.
Sure, so that is a lot of ground to cover. But yeah, like I had mentioned, I have always been the sort of person who I'm fascinated by figuring out how stuff started and where stuff came from. And I also would see these memes and little articles that would go around saying, oh, you know, this practice is from this, or this practice is from that. And every now and then I would see something, I'd be like, well, that doesn't line up with what I do already know about this. I'll give you an example. We will get to the Christmas tree thing, and then everyone can hate me in the comments because that people never like hearing the truth about that. But I was seeing one, for example, about mistletoe. And it was saying, you know, the story of the mistletoe is actually this ancient Norse thing. It comes from Norse paganism, and it's, you know, the goddess Frigga, and she, you know, the mistletoe is this symbol of peace, which is why you kiss under it. And I remember the first time I saw that, I'm like, that makes no sense from actual Norse pagan perspective, because the mistletoe is what she used to kill the god Baldur. So how that would be turned into this symbol of love and peace, it just seems very strange, particularly from Norse paganism, which is not a huge like love and peace oriented form of approaching life, we'll just say. So I started digging into it, and come to find out it's actually a Victorian thing, that the idea of kissing under the mistletoe started with the Victorians, who romanticized everything and created a lot of super fun traditions. I think it's a great tradition. I don't think anything wrong with us, you know, using it today as pagans or not as pagans. But the backstory that gets applied to it is really something that's very modern to kind of justify why it would be okay for pagans to do it. And I think we just need to be aware that we don't need that to justify doing it, especially with the mistletoe, because that's not even a religious thing. That was a secular. Victorians just wanted an excuse to kiss each other, basically.
They really needed excuses, like specific setups, right?
Yeah.
To tell themselves that it was okay to kiss.
Yes. The Victorians are just a fascinating era of history, and they were very focused on things relating to kissing and similar subjects, we'll just say. Lots of love magic.
Language of flowers.
Yes. Yeah. They have a lot of our, not that this is on topic, so I'll be quick, but a lot of our Halloween divination traditions that people think of, like the peeling an apple and seeing if the peel makes the shape of a letter that's supposed to be the shape of, you know, the name of your true love. That's all Victorian. Victorians were really obsessed with figuring out who you were going to marry and who was in love with you and all that fun stuff. And that doesn't mean it's wrong for us to do it now. It just doesn't mean that it's not, it does mean that it's not ancient. There we go. Makes more sense. So, yeah. I think that we as a community tend to want everything to be ancient and pagan, because then we feel like we still have a right to it and to practice it and to do it. And my perspective is a little different on that, because folklore, folk belief, things like that are always evolving and changing. And there's this thing called cultural exchange, where people borrow from other cultures and sort of adapt. This is different from cultural appropriation, which is a power dynamic thing. This is just the natural process of, you know, oh, my neighbors are doing something really fun, and I would also like to have a lot of fun. I think this is a good idea. You know, how would this work from my perspective? And I think we really underrate that that's okay to do. Perfectly fine as a modern pagan to be like, this is a fun tradition and I am also going to do it.
Yeah, like the 12-foot skeletons from Home Depot, you know.
Everyone should have one.
We can be the ancestors that started the tradition of dressing up your 12-foot skeleton.
And you know what, the beautiful thing is, someday in the future that is going to be a tradition.
You're so right.
And it's going to get a cool backstory. And
that is, you know, so funny to think about, because I have a neighbor down the street who's got, it's not even just one skeleton. It's like, and a giant rooster and a like a giant dog skeleton that it's holding a leash, and like a smaller skeleton on top of the rooster. And like, it's a whole family. And the dispensary down the street, they got one of those, it's only half the skeleton, actually. You can just see the upper half kind of like waving at the top of the building. And they've just left it up post-Halloween. Like,
I get it.
Like, slay.
It's, you know, it's big. It's hard to set up. Once it's there, just leave it. It's fine. Decorate it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm even in my house, it's like, oh, you know, scary crow decor from Halloween. Now you have a wreath around your neck. You are the Christmas crow, you know? That's
Put a little Santa hat on it.
We bring out all their Mardi Gras decorations and we just throw them on top of the Christmas tree. So we just have this evolving, highly decorated interior from like the beginning of October until February or March, I think.
I love it. Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, and I think that a lot of the stuff that we have, that we do have sort of the modified backstories for, we'll just say, we don't need them. I mean, you can have them as long as you're sort of acknowledging that this is your creative interpretation of this, but you don't have to justify, like, if you like Santa, it's okay to like Santa as a pagan or as a witch. You don't have to, through a convoluted logical process, convince yourself that he's actually Odin. And if you know anything about Odin as a Norse god, probably not the god you want inviting into your home to give your children gifts.
Don't think so.
Yeah, the Wild Hunt wasn't a Christmas party.
Yeah. No.
But, you know, I do think there can be something, as long as we are, you know, do have these caveats and recognize that, you know, there's not a direct line of evidence for a lot of this stuff. I think we can still sort of appreciate the vibe,
Yeah,
right? That
exactly.
it might not be this the same thing. The Christmas tree is probably not, you know, the world tree, but it's kind of got that vibe. And I think we can still go with it in that realm and be like, you know, for us, this can represent the world tree, but, you know, maybe leave off some of the what we now know is really inaccurate about the historic record, and realize that the historic, you know, anything that's scientific is never written in stone. So even like, you know, Maria Gimbutas's work on the ancient goddess cult, that for a long time it was like really in vogue to just say that she was a crazy person. And increasingly, there's more stuff that's like, oh, you know, maybe there was more to her writing than we realize because we keep finding new stuff. So I think that's something that people outside of the sciences or outside of academia often, instead of recognizing that academia is an ongoing conversation and it's always open-ended, they're just like, oh, no, this is the theory that's in vogue right now. Therefore, this is my big T truth. And anything outside of it, we're gonna, you know, leave aside. And yeah, it's super important and also always provisional, you know. Yeah.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I was gonna strongly dispute that the world tree was a conifer because very like I'm in the camp that it was an ash tree. Just wanted to say that. Yggdrasil was an ash tree.
Well, my world tree
Team
is the
ash
bald
tree.
cypress, so fight me.
Well, and I think that's a great example of how creativity can apply. So again, this is the part where everyone's gonna hate me in the comments, but I have sources I can cite. The idea of the Christmas tree per se comes from 15th century Germany. It was a Protestant thing. It actually started with them decorating trees outside of churches. They were called paradise trees because October 24th is the celebration of Adam and Eve. This is all stuff I did not know until I researched this, by the way, because it's very niche knowledge. And a couple hundred years later, that idea of decorating these trees in front of the church for this day turned into bringing them into the home to decorate them. The decorations got more elaborate. And then it spread from there in the 18th century, 19th century to England. And then once it becomes fashionable with English monarchy, it just is a plague upon the world from there. So, we kind of have a pretty solid idea of how Christmas trees started, where they started, the original concepts. I have a Christmas tree in my home. I really don't care that it was originally a Protestant thing. I use it in a different way. My Christmas tree happens to be a goth pagan Christmas tree.
Love it.
So it's black and it has ghosts on it. But, that's my creativity coming
That's what
through.
makes you happy.
Yeah, if you want to say, okay, I'm using this tree symbolically to represent the world tree. And, because Yule is a big traditional pagan celebration in the Norse cultures, and this is what it's going to symbolize to me. If you want to say this represents, the world tree in a different cultural context, or, in Ireland, there was a concept of what was called the Béal, the big sacred tree. And if you want to say, okay, that's what this is a sacred tree that we're setting up to remind us this time of year, whatever. There's nothing wrong with any of that. Like it doesn't have to have an ancient pagan origin for us to do it. We can be creative and say, okay, this is something that is moved beyond just this one, Christian Protestant idea. A lot of people have Christmas trees that aren't Christian at all. Even atheists will put up Christmas trees because it's just a secular thing at this point. So why not do it, and why not do it in a way that makes us happy or feel spiritually fulfilled, or whatever. And we can do it even if it's not, traceably ancient and pagan.
I think we have to accept that, like, this is the culture that we've inherited. And like you said, we can associate it with whatever we want.
And some of the discourse around like, oh, everything that's fun is pagan, like that actually, my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is at least some of that goes back to the Puritans who just wanted everyone to hate life. And so they took even stuff within Christianity and they were like, it's pagan, you have to get rid of it. Like, you
Oh my
know, in
God.
more contemporary times, the talking heads say, like, there's a war on Christmas. But actually, like, the only real war on Christmas we had in the United States historically was
It's the
like
Puritans.
the Puritans who hated Christmas and made it illegal. And
Yeah,
it's
you're
like, and said it
very
was
accurate
pagan.
in saying they just hated everything and they did not want anyone to enjoy life at all. But the thing to keep in mind too, and I think this is a bit of context that a lot of people just, again, you don't have it if you don't look into it. When the Puritans said that Christmas celebrations were pagan, they did not really mean like what we would consider pagan, like polytheist pagan. They meant Catholic. Because to
Wild.
them, yes, to them, the Catholics were pagan. They were not real Christians. And it was sort of a dig at Catholic practices.
Down in the South, there are still some evangelicals who would agree with that.
Yeah, I can still
Yeah.
remember the first time. I wasn't raised Christian for a little bit of personal context. I still remember the first time someone who was Protestant tried to explain to me that Catholics were pagans, and I got so confused. Because to me, they're all just Christians. It's different
Right.
flavors of Christian. And to have like the one group of Christians being like, no, those other Christians are pagan. And I'm like, they're really not, though. No, it's yeah, very confusing. But there's a lot of anti-Catholic stuff that now gets perpetuated as they were talking about like polytheist pagans, which they did not intend it that way. So
Yeah.
yeah.
There's some good sociology, like very contemporary sociology out there about like religious labeling and how a lot of sort of more fundamentalist Christians have gotten away from even using the term Protestant or evangelical or even Baptist. They just self-define as Christian and therefore, by implication, define anyone outside of their church or their sect as being not Christian or not Christian enough. It's this really interesting thing that's really only been written about in the last like 20 years. Like earlier than that, you know, evangelicals identified as evangelical Christians, but then by implication recognized that there were other kinds of Christianity. But since it's become its current iteration of a political movement as much as a religious movement, it's just become the sort of the shorthand. Like I know and interact with people, and when I have conversations or bring this up, yeah, they don't think of themselves as Baptist, even though they go to a Baptist church, because for them, Baptist just means Christian, and therefore, you know, Pentecostals aren't Christian, and Mormons definitely are. You know, like everyone else is just outside of the club. They're in the on the hell train, you know.
And that's so fascinating because it wasn't that long ago on a historical perspective that, you know, Protestants tended to have some sense of unity even among different sects. So like the Methodists and the Lutherans and even the Baptists, there was some general understanding that they disagreed on things, but that they were all under this umbrella. So definitely not a great sign, I don't think, that
Yeah, no, I agree.
they're getting that way. Although I will say, you know, because I just am on a mission, I guess, for everyone to hate me in the comments, that we as pagans and witches, I think we need to be really cautious in the United States about adapting that mindset. Because I have seen some of that going on, especially in the last 5 to 8 years, where people get very like they're not really pagans, they're not really witches, you know, because of whatever. And it again, having been involved in this since the 90s, it used to be like it didn't matter what the differences were, you were just so happy to find someone else who also thought the Irish gods were real that everyone was, you know, in a community with everyone. And I think we're starting to also see some maybe concerning splintering with people deciding that only they represent the real pagans or the real witches or what have you.
I very much agree with you. I think honestly, just life advice. I hope there's no one hating anybody else in anybody's comments. Like, don't do that, first of all. Don't live your life around hating, and don't live your life around gatekeeping people from a thing.
I joke about the hatred in the comments, but it's just, I realize when you challenge people's core beliefs, if you're saying something that contradicts something that someone has incorporated almost as part of their identity, you know, they consider that part of who they are, an aspect of part of who they are, people get very defensive and very upset. Nobody likes to be told that something that they've really strongly believed is just factually not accurate historically. And so I joke about, I know that I'm going to say some things that are going to challenge people in ways that they're not going to appreciate hearing.
But that can be a useful exercise in really starting to like be too attached to things that as we get more information, like the Christmas tree thing. I think I might have shared the whole meme about, oh, the Christians stole this from us. Turns out we stole it from the Christians. Or I don't know if stealing is even the operable word here, but yeah, it's cultural exchange. So with that sort of established, where do we get the best information about pre-British Isle traditions? And like, can we find pre-Christian traditions that we can roll into our modern practice?
Sure. For Ireland and the UK, it is a little tricky. Ireland in particular, because we really don't have anything in writing before Christianity came in. It just, nothing survived. Even the earliest Christian writing in Ireland did not survive. Most of what we have is from the 9th century forward, and sometimes those are copies of earlier things, but it's just the nature of, you're writing it on vellum, which is a little hardier than paper, but it's still, you know, it's got a lifespan to it, particularly before like modern preservation technologies were coming in.
And Ireland's so wet. So much moisture.
So this is a tad bit damp. Yes, that's true. And the UK, you know, more generally as well. So we have a little more when it comes to England, because of the Anglo-Saxons coming in and that period. Again, we don't go super far back, but a little bit further with some of the writing we have. The Venerable Bede, I'm not going to remember exactly, 7th century, I think, is when he was writing, but he tells us some pagan material, or references some pagan things. And then we have some Roman writings. And you always want to take the Romans with a gigantic grain of salt, because anything the Romans were writing about a culture that was not Roman is propaganda. It just is. You know, it doesn't mean we can't get some knowledge from it, but you just have to be aware that, you know, they had a vested interest in making the not Romans look bad.
And I mean, the Romans weren't a monolith, right? They conquered and conquered and conquered and subsumed a bunch of cultures within their culture. So even what is Roman, what era of the Roman Empire are we even talking about?
Because they had the Interpretatio Romana. So they would go into a new area and they would be like, that's an interesting thunder god you have there. But you know, his real name is Zeus. Like, you might not have known that, but that's who that actually is. And so we start to see all these like hyphenated, like in England, in Bath, they have Sulis Minerva. And Sulis was the original pagan goddess in that area. But the Romans rolled in and were just like, but actually, that's Minerva. You just didn't realize that because you're, you know, too ignorant and silly. So we're going to tell you who your gods really are. And that definitely was good in the sense that it preserved some things that we might not have otherwise had preserved, but is bad in that because they were making these equations, we're making a lot of assumptions based on who they were associated with the Romans, because we don't have a lot of other information. And I don't know that the Romans were necessarily really accurate in how they were doing this. They were very surface, like, you know, this must be this. Don't worry about the details. File off the serial numbers. It's fine. So we do have some information, but You just had to be cautious. This is something I actually say for the Irish material we do have as well, that not so much the sources that we're dealing with per se, because the older material does have a lot of pagan going on with it, but we're dealing with translations, the majority of people. And translations are always going to be inaccurate to some degree. Because I'll see a lot of people who try to argue like very, very specific spiritual points based on a translation of a text, like one word or one phrase. And when you go back to the actual source text, that's not really what it says. You know, the translator chose this particular word, but the original word has all these other meanings and connotations to it. So you just need to be very cautious in like how hard you're going at some of this source material, and sort of what you're building from there. Again, creativity is awesome. Modern interpretations are awesome. Personal gnosis, I'm a huge fan of it. Just be careful in not getting like the way, I guess, Christian fundamentalists will do, where they'll argue a Bible verse, and we don't want to do that with pagan material because it's probably doesn't work well for Christians either. I don't know much about that, but definitely doesn't work well with a lot of pagan material because of the layers of translation happening. And I'm sorry, we just went off on a little bit of tangent from the original question. We don't have a lot of material for how the solstice would have been celebrated in Ireland and the UK originally. What we do have a lot of for pagan material is the Norse, because the Norse were Christianized considerably later than most other cultures. And the Norse also got around. For anyone who wasn't aware of that already, they settled in Scotland. They had a strong influence in England. They actually had settlements in Ireland. Dublin, which is the capital of the Republic of Ireland, is named for the Norse because it was at one point a Norse city. I don't think we always like understand like how much Norse influenced a lot of things. And Norse solstice practices, we know a fair amount about. And a lot of that can be incorporated into modern pagan and witchcraft practices, because clearly the Norse were very happy, the pagan Norse, spreading it around everywhere anyway, along with a bunch of other things that they were spreading around. So, including their DNA. We have things like the holding a vigil on the night of the solstice, the idea that you want to stay up during the longest night so you can greet the sun on the next morning, welcome the return of the light, celebrate that it's going to be a little bit lighter every day from that point forward, particularly because I think we always feel like we're going into the depths of winter moving forward from the solstice, even though we are literally getting more light every day. So kind of holding on to that idea, and you can see how much more powerful that would be in places where the night is much longer than it is, you know, perhaps in like the continental United States, for example. You know, there's parts, if you go far north enough, where the sun just doesn't rise for a little while, you just get nighttime.
It's rough.
It is. I have a lot of respect for people who live in those places, because that's that, and in the summer, the sun doesn't set thing. I don't think I could handle perpetual sun myself. So we have things like that. We have the Yule log. That's a Norse tradition. We actually find that as well in Scotland because, again, of this influence. They would get this gigantic log and they would light it on the beginning of the night of the solstice, and it would burn throughout the whole night. And again, as part of this vigil, you would tend this giant log as it burned. And the idea was it's supposed to be big enough that one log would last the whole night. And a way that I've adapted that, and I know other people in my area have as well, and I'm sure more widespread than just here, because we do not have a functional fireplace at my house, and I'm not keen on trying to burn my house down for solstice celebrations. Mm-hmm. It would be very festive and bright for that, you know, one night. Probably not the best idea. So what we have is we have a smaller log that has been drilled so it can have candles in it. Ooh, and we light candles.
Very cool.
Yep. And because I do not do the overnight vigil myself for a variety of reasons, what I do with my children is when we get up in the morning, because we do presents on the solstice morning, we will light the lights, the candles on the Yule log, and do a little ritual around that, and then do presents and the whole rest of the thing. And presents are a universal concept. Anyone can have presents.
Yes.
No one invented the idea of presents.
Yep. Presents do not belong to any culture. Everyone gets presents.
Everyone gets presents.
Yeah, we might as well get that out of the way. Presents for everyone. So I think there's traditions like that that we know are pagan. We're originally pagan, but we don't necessarily have to celebrate them the exact way that they were done historically. It's okay to modify or try to figure out like what's going to work the best for you personally. If you do not have a gigantic walk-in fireplace to put an enormous tree trunk log in, then, you know, I know some people who do have a working fireplace that will just feed the fire all night, and that's their metaphoric Yule log. Like I said, I use a log with candles in it, and I light the candles. There's a lot of ways that you can incorporate these things that are still true to the spirit of the tradition, which I think is the important part.
Yeah, and I think that by integrating some of these traditions with some of the other traditions, you kind of get like this, you know, a little bit of a hodgepodge of a winter celebration. But like you said, you know, there's winter celebrations throughout the world around, well, I mean, at least the Northern Hemisphere. You see a lot of different cultures celebrating this in different ways. And as we as like 21st century people, we get to kind of pick and choose, you know, we get maybe a little bit of Hanukkah if, you know, we have friends in the Jewish community. You know, we can get some pagan traditions in. We can even get some newer traditions like Festivus, the holiday for the rest of us, where we air our grievances, which I think is a useful way to round out our calendar year. So yeah, I think that's something to keep in mind for folks who are like, you know, trying to, I don't know, just like only celebrate one kind of way of depicting their winter holidays, where it's like, nah, let's you know, try a little bit of everything, and as long as we're doing it respectfully and in the spirit of you know, engendering goodwill, which I think one of our earliest solstice episodes, we talked about how like these traditions were adaptive for peoples to come together to survive the colder winter months, and also like engender goodwill, because when you're giving each other presents, you don't want to kill each other. And that's really important when you're stuck inside for a really long, long time.
Yes. Yeah. I was just going to mention that a lot of these are traditions from places where, you know, once winter hit, you were really spending a lot of time with not your nuclear family, because that's a very modern concept, but your whole extended family. And that's, you know, we think the holidays are stressful today. I can only imagine what spending a month or two pretty much constantly with extended family would be like, even if you like all of your family.
And
just
like,
yeah, a lot.
Not even having your own bedroom to go close the door, right? It's like you're in it. Y'all are around the fire,
yep,
for a long time in a space together.
Yep. Well, this is why we have so many storytelling traditions around the winter solstice, because that's another practice that, again, is not really culture specific or religious specific. It's just something we find in a lot of places across Western Europe, at least, which is, you know, where I'm mainly familiar with, but I'm sure elsewhere as well, because you did not have anything else to do. There were certain amounts of work that could get done, things like sewing and weaving and that sort of thing. But even that, you were sitting in place, you know, you could talk, you could tell stories, it passed the time. A lot of these epic myths that we have today were originally these oral stories that people would tell across, you know, days or weeks in order to pass the time. And it also sort of builds the sense of community. And I think that is another thing we could definitely preserve and continue today. But also just appreciate that like storytelling is very, very deeply rooted in this time of year. Little random fun fact, again, I'm not trying to pick on the Victorians, but this is an aspect of Christmas celebration that I think we all should continue today, no matter what our spirituality. It's Christmas ghost stories.
Yes.
Victorians were huge on Christmas ghost stories, and I think that is fabulous, and we need to do that more.
I love just ghost stories in general.
Yeah. We've lost our concept of spooky Christmas. It needs to come back.
I think spooky Christmas is coming back, though. There's a lot of, like, I mean, they even do a haunted house here in Portland, because of course they do. But they do, like, a Krampus slash, like, Wild Hunt themed haunted house that you can go to for the holidays. I think, it, you know, some of it's just, like, they want to make more money for the haunted house season, but also it's, and then one of my favorite podcasts, You're Wrong About, they're doing a tour where it's like a Christmas seance, where they talk about that connection between Christmas and ghost stories. And yeah, and like we mentioned this a little bit last year when we talked to Dara about the Norse traditions, is that this time of year was scary. It wasn't a like shiny, happy, you know, elves making toys. And it wasn't sort of like you see in The Nightmare Before Christmas where it was like opposite of each other. It was like, this was a terrifying time of the year. The Yule Cat would eat you if you didn't wear new clothes. You know, the Wild Hunt would be going through the towns, finding anybody who wasn't in with their family during the holidays and slaughtering them right then and there. Like, this was almost like a time of a lot of anxiety. And like, yeah, let's bring that back. I think especially with the Charles Dickens thread of like making rich people scared of how they haven't contributed to our society, make them scared again.
Yeah, make rich people scared to be selfish.
Make rich people scared again.
Yeah. It's a good philosophy for the season.
Mara, there we go.
it's already happening, right?
Yeah,
definitely.
I think that we, particularly in the first world countries, first world places, for a lot of us, we've lost touch with that fear that people had that you didn't know if you were going to see the next spring. You didn't know if you were going to make it through the winter for a multitude of reasons, that you could get sick, you know, without modern medicine, antibiotics, all of that, like illness was a much more significant problem than it is today, which I don't think we appreciate enough. Food might not last. You might not be able to hunt fresh game, depending on how that was going around you. There was just all this whole list of things that could go wrong that were more likely in winter. I mean, these could happen throughout the whole year, but winter was really the time of year when you were the most aware, I think, of how like tenuous life can be. Mm-hmm. And it's the same psychology behind why Halloween is the way it is, at least in the modern context. It's actually healthy to confront these fears externally through things like stories. And it gives us an outlet to express things that we're afraid of or anxious about in a supportive community setting, where we're not just sort of dwelling on our own and, you know, being afraid that we might get eaten by a giant Yule Cat. You know, everyone can share that.
Right. Yeah. So on the topic of stories, our sort of theme this year for the holiday cards is the Kaliak. And she's sort of this mysterious figure that I have to say, I don't really know much about her, but I know that she is considered to be the crone of winter, which is interesting. Like, I guess some sort of modern interpretation of her is as the Christmas witch. But I wanted to know what you know about her and like how she does relate to this time of year.
Sure. So there's kind of two main different Kaliaks that are out there. There's the Irish one, which is a totally different thing. But then there's the Scottish one. And the Scottish Kaliak, the Kaliak Vor, the Blue Hag, is very much associated with winter. And there's all these stories in Scottish folklore about how usually at Samhain, around the end of October, beginning of November, she would kind of take over the year. In some versions, it's she is contrasted with Brigid, Bridget would have sort of the warm, happy time of year, and then the Kaya comes in and has the dark winter, the stormy time. She's associated very much with storms and the cold and snow and all of that. And then she would be in control until, in some versions, March 25th, which in Scotland is known as the Day of the Kaya. In others, until Bjálchina, the 1st of May. And this idea that she kind of had the dark half of the year, you know, in modern pagan terms. And then Brigid would have the light half. And in some of the stories, she keeps Brigid prisoner during this period. And then Brigid finally escapes or overcomes her. In other versions, though, they are two halves of one being. So she drinks from this waterfall or this water source in the spring that turns her it back into Brigid. And then when the fall comes around, the cold weather comes around, she transforms into the Kaliakvor, into the storm hag, and is the same being, the same energy, the same goddess, but she has these two kind of opposing faces depending on the time of year. And there's a bunch of different sayings and traditions associated with that to do with like how bad the winter would be based on, you know, how the weather was on certain days associated with her. On the March 25th on the Kaliak day, there's this idea that if the day was fair and bright, this is kind of really the way we would in the US look at Groundhog's Day, that means you're going to have a longer winter. That means the Kaliak, they would say the Kaliak is out collecting firewood for her hearth. So therefore you were going to have an extended period of cold after that. But if that day, if the 25th of March was stormy or rainy or bad weather, she couldn't go collect the firewood and therefore the spring would come sooner, which I just think is a much more fun way than Groundhog's Day. But I like the storytelling aspect of it more than the, you know, Groundhog sees its shadow thing.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense, honestly.
Yeah, and definitely a little more pagan. Although we could probably argue that Groundhog's Day is an awfully pagan, superstitious practice that we have in the
Very
United
much.
States. Yeah,
but didn't that also come from the Victorians?
Yeah,
and their weird cult around the groundhog.
Oh, the Victorians.
Yeah,
the Victorians are the source of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. The Victorian era is kind of also, this would have been like mostly through the 1800s, early 1900s, was the first time we really in the UK and Ireland and the US had a middle class. You know, prior to that, you were either wealthy or you weren't. And then we kind of the industrial age comes in and we start to see this idea of the middle class coming, people who were well off enough to have leisure time, but weren't like wealthy. And the middle class Victorians were bored and very creative and did a lot of wacky things that I think today we don't really appreciate enough, besides the inventing kissing under the mistletoe stuff and the groundhog and a lot of love divination. Like this is all coming from this same period of time where people suddenly had free time and filled it with things. This is also when we see stuff like spiritualism starts, theosophy starts during the same time period. People had more time to focus on spiritual questions and assorted ceremonial magic practices. So it made for an interesting era of history.
And also, you know, during the Victorian time, we have colonialism, which made the British, my understanding is, made the British middle class really obsessed with having their own culture in order to be not the other. And so there it could have had some aspects there of, you know, increased printing and newspapers. So you have a bit more of a massification of culture, and you're subjugating people around the world, which is what created the British middle class. But you also, you know, there was, especially in the colonies, such a huge push to not go native, big air quotes, can't be any bigger air quotes around that. But so there was, I feel like, a lot of internal pressure to be as British as possible, to justify supremacy and all of the things.
I think the time period we see sort of two antithetical things happening. We see a lot of nationalism, which is what you're talking about, this idea of we need to define ourselves as, you know, in the US to be Americans, or as British, or Irish in Ireland. And that definitely was a push for, like, we are obviously superior and we're, again, air quotes, civilized and et cetera. But there's also an obsession with foreign cultures. And there was a lot of romanticism, and there's a term for it, and I'm not going to remember it offhand, but exotification.
Orientalism.
There was a lot of this idea of they were mystical and magical, and they were more primitive, again, air quotes. I do not espouse any of these beliefs. I'm just repeating what was going on in the time period, to be clear. And this idea of this is when we really start to see a lot of folklore collections focusing on foreign cultures, which, again, we have to be super careful when we're reading Victorian material for this reason, because they were coming at it from this perspective of, oh, isn't this novel and fascinating? And you see a lot of people who got very into the idea of importing bits and pieces. This would be cultural appropriation of other cultures. You see the whole weird thing that went on with the Egyptian cultures, and we, you know, stole a huge amount of things from Egypt. But, you know, the Victorians liked to use mummies in a lot of ways that mummies were never, ever supposed to be used. They made paint out of them. They ate them. And I wish I was making that up, but unfortunately I'm not. Like, there was a lot of weirdness that went on because of this kind of obsession with other cultures and, like, what they could strip mine from them, which does, I think, also play a role in some of the things that were going on at the time.
Yeah, definitely. And sort of also, like, the rise of the travelogue and, yep, you know, this constant refrain of, like, ancient Egypt was so amazing. It would be nice if none of these contemporary Egyptians were around, so we could just go gallivant and have our, you know, our amusement park of ancient society. But unfortunately, yeah, there are too many people there right now. Sort of that kind of, like, romanticize the past while vilifying the descendants of the people you're romanticizing. Just,
yeah, yeah, you could just say Aleister Crowley. You could just say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Theosophy is actually a great example of everything we're talking about, because it gets pitched very much as this is a very, very modern Western way to approach magic and approach belief, and it's clearly much more evolved and understanding. But the bones of it are basically just strip mining all of these other cultures and then throwing them in a blender and saying, well, you know, the things they believe in India and the things they believed in, you know, the Middle East and all these other places, if you throw them all together and just pick out the bits that are the shiniest that we like the most, but then we're going to pretend like this is actually the big universal spirituality that everyone should see and understand, and not that they're creating it that way from those sources. And they kind of made it into a very British thing. In particular, spiritualism.
And not that
Blavatsky, but Blavatsky.
Yeah, not that Blavatsky was British, but it was definitely rooted in sort of this racial hierarchy that completely supported white supremacy, which, you know, a lot of Victorian traditions were really keen on doing.
Profoundly. Don't even get me started on the white supremacy in a lot of Victorian fairy lore, because that's a significant issue. But Blavatsky, I think, is a great example, though, of someone who is coming from outside 19th century British culture, but then tried to make herself the epitome of that culture. You know, the best way to fit in and to seem like you belong to it is to act like you're embodying some key aspect of it. And I think that was, I mean, Blavatsky, we could do a whole episode about Blavatsky, yeah, but I think that she's a good example of that, which was certainly something that was happening on a wider scale. She was definitely not the only one who was coming in and then trying to be more British than the British.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that actually gives me like some thoughts for bringing you back on the show, because I would really love to do this critical race theory on the British Isle fairy traditions. Like,
Oh
that would
wow,
be
yeah.
amazing. So let's put a pin in that for next time.
I'd be willing to do it because a lot of people don't realize how embedded that is, even in ideas that we still have in paganism and witchcraft today, because it's coming from those sources, and we're not aware of kind of that angle of it.
And I think that's a really important thing to do moving forward, is just deconstructing some of the white supremacy that's inherent in these ideas of what we think is paganism, which really comes from, colonialism and white supremacy of the Victorian age. So, yeah, that's a really good topic to pursue, because, I want to make sure I'm not perpetuating white supremacy in my like paganism. Last year, interesting how the solstice episodes kind of break open this topic, because we were talking about some of the modern practitioners of Norse beliefs, and the whole nine noble virtues is white supremacy. It's like comes from a lot of white supremacist ideas about the folk. What is it? The folk Azatru traditions that are based in around white supremacy. So yeah, like I think that there's value in both knowing these traditions, but then understanding like, okay, how do we take what this is and then not perpetuate racism, not perpetuate white supremacy, not perpetuate colonialism?
Right. I think I am so on board with everything you're talking about right now. I think it's hugely important for us to be willing to dig into this, even the things that are unpleasant, and to sort of adapt if you realize, okay, this thing that I've been doing or that I'm very attached to is actually coming from sort of a poisoned well. So how can I now remove that aspect of it, but continue to have the beliefs that matter to me? Like what direction can I go in so that I can still do the things that are important to me, but without having this through line that is really problematic? Because I do think that's possible. I think whatever we're talking about, there's ways to be like, okay, this particular angle, this particular understanding is a problem, and this is why. So how do we pivot? How do we remove that without just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which I think unfortunately is what a lot of people do if they find out, okay, this is a problematic source. The nine noble virtues come from Odinism, which is a very particularly white supremacist branch of, and it always has been, of heathenry. But I like the idea of nine noble virtues. Well, write your own. Just don't use the ones that they gave you, which are, like you said, they're drawn from less than ideal places that we don't want to perpetuate ourselves. But the core idea of having nine as a big number in heathenry, having nine virtues or nine personal qualities or nine goals, however you want to look at it, that in and of itself isn't bad. You just want to look at that and be like, how can I do this in a way that's not pulling from white supremacy or colonialism or, any of the other things that we really don't want to continue? I assume we don't want to continue.
We here at the Science Witch podcast do not want to perpetuate white supremacy in any form or fashion. So, yeah, thank you
Make that
so much,
abundantly
Morgan.
clear. Yeah.
And so, we've been talking about an hour here, which has come by so fast. And
Very fast.
I really enjoyed this conversation. Before we wrap up, I want to make sure Inku, if
Well,
there's
I
anything.
wanted to jump back to a little nugget that you started to show us, which is the distinction between the Scottish and the Irish Cailleac
Oh, sure.
stories or traditions.
Sure. So for a little history lesson for those that don't know, Scotland had an original indigenous population, which we would call the Picts. We know very little about them for a variety of reasons. But Scotland was also settled by the Irish. So, and I want to say it was around the 4th or 5th century, the Dalryda Irish settled on the west coast of Scotland and then spread from there, particularly spread culture from there, which is why the modern Scottish language is actually rooted in Old Irish, and is sort of a cousin language to modern Irish, because colonialism, basically historic colonialism. And so we have a lot of what we would, I guess, refer to as paganism and pagan beliefs in Scotland that are influenced by or sourced from the Irish. Brigid is an example. Angus, who's another Irish god, is found in Scotland. And we have the Cailleac. The Cailleac in Ireland is mostly centered in the southwest. You do find her kind of everywhere, but her main area is mostly like around Cork in particular. And she's really not a winter goddess. She's not a storm goddess. She's associated more with like creation, shaping the land. In some stories, she's the wife of Manon and Mac Léir, who's a god of the sea, and others. She's potentially one of the Tuatha Danann and the wife of the god Lu. It gets very complex, and I could go on for a whole hour about that, so I don't want to get too far into it. But we sort of know who she is in that folklore and how she's understood. But the idea of her, the concept of her as a goddess, was brought over to Scotland with these Irish settlers, and grew and sort of took on its own nature. And you can look at this as another aspect of the Cailleac, another part of who she is. You can look at this as maybe a sister deity to the Irish one. There's all sorts of ways to approach polytheism, so I'm not going to dictate how you have to understand this. But the Scottish Cailleac we see, as I mentioned, is much more associated with winter and storms and snow, and all of those things, which are not the same in Ireland. Particularly Cork, you really don't have like really hard winters. Tongue in cheek, thanks to climate change, that is changing a little bit. We have seen a lot more sort of severe, particularly windstorms in Ireland recently, and more snow. But historically, in the past, that was sort of a different environment, a different weather system going on. So we see her moving in a different direction and being associated with that. And like I said, she's known as the Cailleac Vóir, the Blue Hag. Cailleac, by the way, is not really a name; it's a title. There's some theories on what her name is in Ireland, but again, that would be a bit of a tangent. Cailleac is a word that was actually borrowed from Latin, which is not uncommon with older Irish. It just means veiled one. So it's a term that was used for nuns. It's used for older women. It's often translated now as hag or witch, kind of that idea of,
Sexism.
yeah, gotta love it. It's kind of that concept of an older, powerful woman, I guess, is the best way to sort of put it in a modern context. So the Cailleac Vóir, the Scottish idea of this storm goddess, is still very much kind of in line with the wider energy of it, but a different personality, a different specific energy from what we find in Ireland.
Yeah,
That is
there's
the
a
absolute Cliff
beautiful.
Notes version of that.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. There's a beautiful mural of the Cailleac in Drogheda, and Drogheda has a lot of just amazing murals. But there's one of the Cailleac that we'll put in the show notes for
Oh
listeners
yeah.
to be able to see a representation there. But
There's
yeah,
an
she's.
amazing artist in Ireland named Jane Bridson, and she's done a lot of work. She has actually has a whole oracle deck based around the Cailleac.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so her artwork I always recommend to people because she does a variety of it, and it shows different energies, different types. So something else people might want to check out.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
For
she has
holiday
a
presents.
yes. She has a mural that's up at, I believe it's the Visitor Center at Tara. I might be misremembering because I saw this 8 years ago now. But I know she does have her artwork in some significant places in Ireland.
Awesome. Well, yeah, and then our holiday card for this year is going to feature the Cailleac. And I live in the Pacific Northwest, and so this is also a storm time. This is when the king tides happen. which I want to rename the Crone Tide. So let's get that going in the in the lexicon. So yeah, that'll probably, I'll incorporate some of that into the card that folks that are supporters will be getting, including all of our authors and guests this year. I always like to send that out as like a thank you for coming on the show and being a part of the Science Witch podcast project. And so thank you, Morgan, for coming on. And I think we definitely will have to have you back, since, you know, Inku is a avowed fanboy of your work.
Thank you for having me on. I love that we got to cover so much ground and get into to so many different sort of niche topics that a lot of times people don't discuss.
Yeah, and
one of the fun things about the overall project here at the Science Witch podcast is thinking about science very broadly. So like social science, not just, mm-hmm. you know, not just the material sciences, but so like thinking scientifically about history and archaeology and what it means for today is like definitely our wheelhouse here. So
mm-hmm. I love that. You guys yes. are awesome.
Thank you. And you're awesome as well. And so before we close out, do you have anything you want to let our listeners know, or any sort of like new projects you got coming up? I mean, obviously you've been really into the fairy literature coming up. So yeah, like what do you got going on?
Yeah, I always have way too much going on. I just had a book come out, Celtic Fairies in North America, which is looking at folklore around belief in specifically Celtic cultural fairies in Canada and the US and Mexico. I have a book coming out next May called Paid with a Kiss, which is looking at love and sex in fairy belief. Because believe it or not, that is the most commonly asked question that I get, things related to that topic. So I just wrote a book about it. And then later next year, I have a book on the Irish Pantheon coming out, and then collection of translations. So I do translate Old and Middle Irish into English, and I've been working on trying to find the material that specifically is pagan, talks about the gods and goddesses, or the Ishi, the fairies, the other folk, and offer new translations. Most of what we have is over 100 years old and is very Victorian. And if you haven't already gathered, the Victorians are not the best source to look to for things. So that's coming out next year. And I just finished up writing a book about the fairy courts, or I am just finishing up, I should say. It's not quite done yet. So that's looking at the fairy courts from Scottish folklore through modern belief. And I think people will find that interesting, but we'll see.
No doubt. I'm already, yeah, plotting for purchases.
Yeah, I keep busy, so I write far too much.
I feel like you write as much as we can consume. So like, yeah, let's get you back on the show to talk about some of these interesting topics we kind of started to talk about but did not have time for this time. But thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for your work and your helping us debunk some of these Victorian myths that we might have erroneously associated with paganism. And
when in doubt, blame the Victorians or blame the Puritans.
Pick one.
Low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
There.
Probably one of them.
Yep, exactly. If you're not sure, just pick one and you're 50% chance you're right. So it's fine.
All right. Well, yeah. So thank you so much for being our solstice episode for this season or this year. And
thank you so much to Morgan for coming on to the show for our special solstice episode. Be sure to check out her books, writing, and stay tuned for further episodes with her, since she was such a great guest to have on, and we touched on several topics that we definitely want to circle back to later on.
If you want to support our podcast and help us out monetarily, check us out on Patreon. At the $1 a month level, you will get early access to ad-free episodes before we put them out on the main RSS feed. And we are hoping to pick up our first official sponsors sometime in the beginning of next year. So this will be the only way to get an ad-free listening experience. Also, at the $1 a month, you get access to a variety of eclectic offerings, including videos from my yoga practice, recordings of meditations and sermons from Inku that he posts on his UU congregation, and recipes for witchifying your holidays. Also, at this level, you will get access to our bonus content, including our short form podcast series, Who's in Bloom, which talks about how much we love flowers, and Tripping Through the Tarot, which is a new series I recently started where we explore the themes around different tarot cards. And the next one we'll be putting out is on the High Priestess, which I've already started writing.
At our $5 a month level, our sticker exchange, you'll receive a sticker in the mail. Angel is currently sending out stickers for the Athena, along with Kaliok's holiday cards. For our Deity Deep Dive series, we are combining our talents to produce a short-form podcast series all about deities we feature in our sticker exchange with original music written by myself. It's been a really fun creative prompt to come up with different scores themed around different deities, and then Angel does research and then writes the episode around it. The Athena episode is now available on our main RSS feed. I was pretty decently happy with the music on that one. Honestly, I kind of want to clean it up a bit and add either words or a cello song or a cello solo to it separately. And yeah, I'm going to be workshopping with that one. And then our next deity deep dive will delve into the details of our Celtic divinity known as Kaliok, Crone of Winter and Goddess of Storms. I'll also be writing music for that in mind for our next offering from the series.
And finally, for just $10 a month, you too can be an initiate in our Science Witch Coven. At that level, you'll get exclusive access to some of the behind-the-scenes aspects of producing the show and be a part of the Science Witch podcast project. Additionally, you'll have free access to Angel's tarot practice that I, too, also chime in on sometimes, and birth chart readings that we like to offer to help keep our astrology skills sharp. This is a chance to meet the producers and co-hosts of the show, and it really helps us to have continued support from our dedicated queerdos out there to recoup some of the costs associated with producing the podcast and helping us earn a little bit of money on the side.
And of course, listening and sharing the podcast with your friends is also invaluable to our success. We are slowly reaching our goal towards getting 1,000 Spotify listeners so we can start to monetize the podcast a bit more and also make joining our Patreon for ad-free episodes even more attractive. If you're looking for community, be sure to check out our Discord server and join in on the discussions of the occult, plant magic, and science.
Finally, if you want to find us on social media, look for us at the Science Witch Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. And I'm going to get us an account for Blue Sky, as that is the new social media platform that everyone is flocking to these days. You can still find us on X, but I don't really go on that site anymore for reasons that we have continued to mention in this outro going on 3 years now. Show notes and transcripts are available on our website at thesciencewitchpodcast.com. And if you want to just email us, you can do that too at questions@sciencewitchpodcast.com. Until next time.
Live long
and prosper
and blessed be.
Yay.